Let's get started with Anthony Blinken's visit to Israel and the outcome of this visit. And how did you find it?
Well, it fit a convincing pattern, which has an unrivaled, unblemished record of failure. It's been the standard practice of the United States as part of the defunct peace process. And in this exercise as well, to formulate a proposal, take it to the Israelis, negotiate with them, make concessions to them, then present it to the Palestinians as an American proposal that we might be able to persuade the Israelis to accept. And in effect, we're advocating an Israeli position rather than one that is formulated by us and that reflects our interests as opposed to the alleged common interests of the US and Israel. And naturally, the Palestinians are not enchanted with this kind of approach. So what has just happened is that once again, the United States has presented a proposal which it pre-negotiated with Israel, which it claims Israel has accepted, but which it's quite clear Israel has not accepted, and which alters the previous offers to the benefit of Israel. And Hamas has taken a very understandable position. Look, we agreed to the proposal you made back at the beginning of July. We do not agree to Israel's usual addition of additional terms to that offer. Therefore, we're not negotiating. We are looking for an implementation plan for the proposal you put forward 2 months ago or a month and a half ago. I would say also that it's very significant that the proposal focuses on hostage release, that is by Hamas, and incidentally, Israel as well. It does not focus on peace. These are not discussions of a ceasefire. They are discussions of a pause in Israel's extermination campaign in Gaza. And I can understand why Hamas might find that unattractive as something to agree to. In any event, it has to be said, as we end near the end of the Biden administration, that Mr. Blinken has probably been the least successful Secretary of State in our history. In this context, he has acted as Israel's lawyer, and he has achieved nothing. What is really at stake here, it seems to me, was the juxtaposition with the Democratic National Convention. This was intended to produce a triumph for former candidate Biden. Now, Mr. Biden is not a candidate. He's on vacation in California. And the candidate has, the actual candidate, has not taken a definite position on Israel-Palestine. If you were Hamas and you were asked to accept what is essentially Israeli amendments to the original offer, with no assurance of what the U.S. administration will look like in a few months, or even what Kamala Harris and Tim Walz stand for on this issue, I think you would not take it. And so we have essentially a breakdown in the talks. And Mr. Blinken, who is clearly a protege, has been a protege of Mr. Biden, President Biden, for years, has just thrown up his hands and gone home, blaming Hamas, of course. That is the normal procedure. We present an offer negotiated with the Israelis. The Israelis usually don't accept it publicly, but try to bargain for more when they have a chance. And the Palestinians don't accept it. And then we blame them for the absence of an agreement. This is largely related to domestic American politics, but it goes back, if you want, to the Clinton effort at Camp David to to produce a last minute peace agreement with the Israelis and the Palestinians. It didn't work. The same procedure. Clinton then blamed the Palestinians. So what's going on is essentially a charade. That is a show for domestic and international political purposes, and I don't think it has much persuasive power.
Yeah, here is a clip that Antony Blinken was addressing this. I think that he was intimidating Iran to not to attack Israel.
To reaffirm the commitment of the United States to Israel's security. That's a commitment that we put into practice virtually every day since October 7th, including when Israel was attacked directly by Iran back in April. In recent weeks, given the heightened tensions, we have deployed additional assets to the region. The purpose of the deployment of these assets is not to provoke aggression, but rather to deter it, to make sure that it doesn't happen. But also to make clear that if it does, we are fully prepared to defend Israel. We've coupled this effort with an intense diplomatic campaign, virtually a global diplomatic campaign, working with countries around the world to send the message strongly to every concerned party not to take any steps that would escalate tensions, that would risk provoking a wider conflict. And this, too, has been something we've been working on from day one since October 7th. It's been one of our primary objectives to prevent the conflict from escalating, from spreading to other places. And so this coupling of our military commitments, our security commitments, with an intense diplomatic campaign is something that I'm pursuing on this trip, again, with the intent of making sure that we deter further conflict, but that we're also clearly prepared to defend against it if it comes. But what's most crucial now is that everyone refrain from taking any actions that could fuel further conflict, escalate tensions, and result in the spreading of violence and conflict.
Yeah.
Well, does deterrence apply to Israel? Do we insist that Israel not take provocative actions? You know, the exchange with Iran that he mentioned back in July, I believe, or was it April? April, I guess. That exchange was provoked by Israel. Israel has continuously provoked things. On July 31st, it carried out two assassinations intended to provoke a wider war. We're not deterring that. So I think this has very little credibility, and I would note that there's very little diplomacy in it either. It seems to involve moving warships around. We are not talking to Iran. We are not talking to Hezbollah. We are not talking to the Houthis. We are not talking to the Iraqi militias. We are not talking to the government of Syria. We are talking to Israel. Well, one hand can't clap. This is not diplomacy. It is posturing. And it's not a surprise that it doesn't work. If we are going to deter a wider conflict, we have to begin with the party that is trying to provoke one. That is not Iran, that is Israel. So I think this is yet another example of a failure by Mr. Blinken to understand diplomacy. The contrast with the Russians, with Sergei Lavrov, with Sergei Shoigu, who went to Tehran with an offer of mediation between Israel and Iran for the same purpose that Mr. Blinken announced, namely to avoid a wider conflict, is striking. Russia talks to all the parties, overtly or covertly. We do not. So that means we are feckless. We cannot achieve much of anything.
Because they were talking about Qataris together with Washington. They were talking about asking Iran not to attack Israel. Please don't attack Israel because we are negotiating. We are reaching an agreement. Right now, he's coming out and trying to intimidate Iran instead of offering something.
Well, again, this is an old pattern. We conducted a peace process, which in retrospect was clearly fraudulent. It was not designed to achieve peace. It was designed to buy time for Israel to create more facts on the ground. And every time there was an effort to, by somebody to produce a peace, our response was, well, no, wait a minute. No, you will disturb the peace process. So now you will disturb the negotiations in Qatar if you do something. So don't do anything. This is a form of deterrence, I guess. But it is not an effort to reach an agreement on anything. And it's not surprising that it hasn't done so.
And how do you see the situation between Israelis and Egypt on Philadelphia corridor?
Well, essentially, Israel is demanding, this is one of the additional conditions Mr. Netanyahu has imposed on this mediation. He is insisting that Israel be allowed to control all of the borders of Gaza, including the border with Egypt. This is a violation of the Camp David Accords and subsequent agreements with Egypt. And it is essentially an Israeli assertion of sovereignty over Gaza. It is part of the same effort that we have seen to deny respect or self-determination to any Palestinian nationalism that may rear its head. And it is very aggravating to Egypt because it basically asserts Israeli control over Egypt's boundary, Egypt's frontier, with another people who are not Israelis. They are Palestinians. So this is an arrogant gesture. One can understand the reasoning behind it, namely to assert total control over Gaza and to repopulate it with Israeli settlements once a sufficient number of Palestinians have died. But even the Israeli armed forces have said this is not necessary, that if they have to control Gaza, they have ways of doing it without holding on to the Philadelphia corridor, the crossing there. So I'm not surprised that the Egyptians have taken this very badly. Why the Palestinians should agree to indefinite Israeli control of them is hard to understand.
You've mentioned how weak Antony Blinken is in implementing the United States foreign policy, but do you think if we had someone else like Bill Burns or someone else who's more capable of doing these type of policies, he would be able to convince Netanyahu within the same framework of the U.S. foreign policy to not continue this type of attitude?
Well, ultimately, everything depends on the president and the White House, and they are pro-Zionist, avowedly so. Mr. Blinken is a Zionist. So essentially, we are asking a Zionist to negotiate terms that are contrary to Zionism with the Zionists in charge in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. This is a losing proposition. Whether Bill Burns, who is a diplomat with a great deal of accomplishment in his record, could have done better or could still is another question. In fact, the White House, given the ineffectiveness of Blinken in this context, has been relying on Bill Burns as a special emissary, also director of the CIA, to conduct the proxy talks between Israelis and Palestinians that have been taking place in Cairo and Doha. And he hasn't been able to succeed. Perhaps that's because the terms that he has been asked to argue for are very pro-Israeli rather than balanced. And maybe he couldn't have done any more than he did.
Because the problem right now within the Arab nations. We recently had President of Algeria talking about that. I'm ready to send Algerian army to Gaza when the borders open. And I swear to God, he said, I swear to God, our army is ready. It shows how this attitude of Israel is getting outrageous in the mind of Arab nations, in the mind of these people who are against the policy of the United States. But is there any consideration within the Netanyahu administration or even the Biden administration toward this attitude, this rhetoric that is totally changing against Israel?
It's hard to say. It's clear that there are some members of the Israeli cabinet who continually make outrageous statements. Smotrich, for example, saying that it would be moral and proper to starve the Palestinians and Gaza to death, and that the only reason Israel has been prevented from that is the objections of so-called allies, meaning protectors like the United States. Ben-Gvir has openly advocated the seizure of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And of course, between the two of them, they're engaged in tremendous expansion of expropriation of Palestinian land in the West Bank. The Israeli cabinet, and apparently the vast majority of the Israeli people, support a policy in Gaza which can only be described as sadistic, a form of sadism, a genocide, and one that shows no empathy at all for women, children, or opponents, male opponents. So I don't know how to answer your question, really.
And how about the Biden administration?
The Biden administration has remained focused on winning the election for Mr. Biden. It has not transitioned to a more appealing posture than that it had, which was intended to appeal to wealthy Jewish and Zionist donors. Plutocrats, men and women of great wealth, who are willing to do almost anything for Israel and who don't care at all about other human beings. And so there's been no change. And Mr. Biden is still the president. I don't envy Kamala Harris. I don't know what her feelings on this are. She's expressed a measure of understanding and empathy for the Palestinians. But this is what I would call paraplegic liberalism. That is, if you're a paraplegic, you cannot move your arms and legs. You can think and you can talk and you can bluster, but you can't do anything. You know, it's even worse than the classic posture we have adopted on this question, which is to wring our hands while sitting on them, also doing nothing.
Because we have two groups when it comes to the 2024 presidential election. If Anthony Blinken wants to help Kamala Harris in 2024, we have donors and voters. Because the way that he's implementing the foreign policy of the United States just benefit the donors of the party. The voters, they're not going to be happy with that.
Well, you know, as an American, I am mainly concerned about my own country and its reputation and its ability to carry out effective policies and to exercise influence abroad. And this war and the American posture on it have utterly destroyed our credibility. We have no credibility on this issue. The statements that come out of Admiral Kirby remind me of Baghdad Bob, if you remember him. What invasion? No invasion. There's no invasion. Baghdad is secure, he said. You can only get away with completely unrealistic defensive comments for so long, as the comments of the State Department spokesman are amazingly off-putting. I mean, nobody believes what the spokesman says. So this is tremendously damaging to the United States. And it's part of Mr. Biden's legacy, unfortunately. It's going to be a tremendous loss of influence around the globe, not just in the Middle East, not just with the Algerians, who experienced their own genocide during the period of the French, their war with the French for independence. I mean, massacres of as many as 45,000 people. And now in Gaza, the number of the dead is not known, but it's certainly more than 200,000. And this is, you know, another conceit of the Western press. They call this the Israel-Hamas war. Well, it's not the Israel-Hamas war. It's a war of extermination against the Palestinians in Gaza. And the figures that Hamas has given out are carefully limited. They do not represent the totality of the deaths or injuries in Gaza. At the moment, 20% of Gazans are on the brink of dying from starvation. And Mr. Smotrich has made it clear this is a deliberate Israeli policy. So there's no doubt anymore about the correctness of the decisions that were made by both the International Court of Justice in The Hague and the International Criminal Court. These are gross violations, not just of human decency, but of international law. And the United States is complicit and defending the indefensible. And this is blowing over into our politics. I don't think Kamala Harris can escape this issue. It has yet to play out in our domestic politics. It is playing out in our foreign policy as more and more countries cease to heed our advice. And I don't think Mr. Blinken's advice to the region, don't do anything, had any traction at all with anybody. It doesn't apply to Israel. Clearly, they keep doing whatever they want. So far, as I've seen, Iran has been very cautious, so has Hezbollah. These are the main two actors who have to respond to the assassinations that Israel carried out 3 weeks ago. As an American, this upsets me. As a human being, I find it difficult to sleep because I know what the people in Gaza are going through. I felt the same way, by the way, after October 7th. I understood what Israelis went through. That was horror. This is a greater horror. This is ongoing, and nobody's trying to stop it.
In your opinion, is there any sort of negotiations, back channels between United States and Iran right now?
I'm sure there must be some form of communication. Historically, we have met in Oman, which has carefully preserved its communication abilities with everybody in the region. We, of course, have not, as I mentioned. We should have an open dialogue with Iran, even if we don't have a formal diplomatic relationship. We ought to have a formal diplomatic relationship. Both Iran and the United States have deep resentments of past injuries to each other. In the case of Iran, it's the Mossadegh overthrow. In the case of the United States, it's the hostage taking, which occurred with the Islamic Revolution. These were respectively, 70 years and how many years? 40 some years ago. 45 years ago. So, adult human beings should be able to realize that we have interests to pursue and we need to set our resentments aside. That is the basic principle of statecraft. There is no statecraft. I think Iran has been very badly hurt by the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed, wants to get rid of them. The new Iranian president has made it very clear that he wants to reach out to the outside world, including the United States. But we are giving him no opportunity to do so. And that is a failure of imagination of statecraft in Washington, not in Tehran. And there's no diplomacy. You can't have diplomacy without communication. So maybe we are communicating back channels somehow. It has happened before, sometimes in an unfortunate manner, as in the effort, the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration. So I hope we are communicating back channel, but I don't think that's a substitute for open, direct, honest dialogue.
In your opinion, one of the main reasons behind this not having any sort of diplomatic relationship between Iran and the United States is Israel. Because at the end of the day, in my vision, Israel would benefit from that. Because if there is some sort of talks between Iran, direct talks, relationship between Iran and the United States, Israel would benefit from that.
Of course, because we would remain very much on the side of Israel. We're not going to abandon Israel. And we would be able to place Israeli arguments as effectively as we could before the Iranian leadership. But I will remind you that Israel once had an excellent relationship with Iran in the time of the Shah. And it had that relationship for geopolitical reasons. Israel is in a quandary because in the 76 years of its existence, it has been dedicated to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and to an approach to its neighbors, which is entirely military. There is not a single instance of Israel making a peace proposal, a proposal to coexist either with Palestinians peacefully within Palestine or with its neighbors more generally. It has instead bombed, strafed, assassinated, and otherwise, and leveraged the power of the United States to punish all of its neighbors. If Israel had a dialogue with Iran, it would be good for both. At least they could honestly discuss their differences. At least Israel, instead of trying to get the United States to go to war with Iran, might have the ability to persuade Iranians to do things that were in the common interest. It doesn't do that. At the moment, the only country that I know of that in the region which has a voluntary good relationship with Israel is Azerbaijan, which supplies oil through a pipeline through Turkey. So the Azeris make money, Israel gets oil, the Turks pretend they don't know about it, and everybody's happy. This is a suggestion that actually there are alternatives to holding someone at the point of a gun or in the sights of a bomber from an aircraft. And Israel, if it is to survive in the long term, sustain its existence, should not be following the example of the vanished Christian kingdoms of the Middle Ages in Palestine. There were two of them. Both of them failed to make peace with their neighbors. Both of them failed to take their neighbors seriously. Both of them failed to meet their neighbors halfway. And both of them ended tragically. Israel at the moment is isolated internationally. It is isolated in the region. It has formal relations with Egypt and Jordan, Bahrain, UAE, and Morocco. But those relations are empty of any support for Israel's legitimacy on the part of those governments. And all of those pieces were engineered by the United States, not by Israel. So Israel needs to discover diplomacy. Once had great diplomats. Abba Ibn, for example, was a great Israeli diplomat. And I think if Israel wants to survive, it has got to come to grips with its neighbors and with its fellow inhabitants of Palestine. And here I'll just conclude by saying I once had a talk with a very wise, very smart Israeli leader who said, you know, the time to make peace is when you're strong, not when you're in trouble. And we are strong. We should make peace. Otherwise, what will happen to us is what happened to the Arabs in Spain. They were there for 800 years. They did not make peace with the troublesome Christian kingdoms in the north. They did not take them seriously. Of course, they were disunited between many, many small emirates in Andalusia and Al-Andalus. And eventually they were gone. In 1492, Jews and Muslims were expelled. Jews found a home in Europe and also also in the Ottoman Empire and in North Africa. I thought that was good advice. Israel has been strong. It cannot remain superior forever. And it should be thinking about how to come to grips with the reality and stop pretending that it can be a European country in the middle of a sea of Arabs and other Muslims.
Yeah. Shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, we had Washington, they're talking about that they don't know what was the purpose of this attack on the Kursk region. Here is a clip.
We're continuing to have the discussions with Ukrainians in terms of their focus. You heard President Zelensky say it was to create a buffer zone. So we're having those conversations to learn more about what their objectives are. Again, if you take a step back from a U.S. perspective, our focus continues to be enabling Ukraine to be a free and sovereign country that can deter Russian aggression in the future. And so that continues to be our focus. As it relates to their operation in Kursk, as I mentioned, they clearly have compelled the Russians to struggle in their response. It has certainly demonstrated the creativity and the battlefield prowess of the Ukrainians. But when it comes to what their longer term objectives are here, that's something that we're still discussing with them. Thank you.
There are a lot of problems with that. First of all, there's a lot of mounting evidence that the British were behind this, worked very closely with the Ukrainians, and did not inform the United States of what they were doing. They seem to be using this incursion as a sales campaign for the Challenger tank and other British equipment, which had previously failed to turn the tide in the failed Ukrainian offensive last summer. I don't think it's mystifying what the Ukrainians are trying to do. I think there were a number of things. One was, of course, to buck up their own morale, which was not high after the failure of their offensive. A second was conceivably to divert Russian forces from the Donetsk front, where they are making steady progress, to the Kursk incursion. A third, I think, since there were negotiations apparently being arranged, and there was some talk between Moscow and Kyiv, was to seize territory that they could trade for their own territory in a negotiation. Mr. Lavrov and others on the Russian side have made it clear that that kind of deception, talking and then basically launching an offensive inside Russian territory, are contradictory, and negotiations cannot proceed under these circumstances. My guess about what is going to happen, despite the fact the Russians have taken their time to respond to the Ukrainian incursion, I think they rather like the fact that the Ukrainians are deepening their incursion. They have begun to attack the logistical support for this military operation. Ukraine basically made a major gamble in launching this. It put its best troops and best equipment into Russia, and it is collapsing on the Donetsk front, where those troops might have been able to help defend Ukrainian territory. What will probably happen, in my view, tragically, is that the Russians will ensure that very few Ukrainians leave Russia alive. Russia is in a position to concentrate its forces and take Ukrainian forces out. And I can do that. It doesn't have to be done initially on the ground. And at the moment, a lot of it is being done from the air or with artillery. And I think this is going to end tragically for Ukraine. And I'm very sorry about that. But, you know, I think it's correct to say that both the Russians and the Ukrainians, who are related peoples, sisters, if you will, or brothers, are very brave, are very ingenious, are very good at wars of attrition. And one has to sympathize with Ukraine. It wasn't Ukraine that got the Russians into this, it was NATO, by refusing to discuss Ukrainian neutrality. And my final observation is that the Defense Department spokesman, when he talks about helping Ukraine be able to deter attacks on it, completely leaves out the political and diplomatic side. Does France now fear attacks from Germany or vice versa? No, because they have reached political arrangements that make it clear that that would be a disaster for both of them. There are, as far as I know, no French artillery aimed at German targets or vice versa. And in the way out of Ukraine's way to alleviate a threat to Ukraine is to deprive the Russians of any incentive to constitute a threat. They could live with a neutral Ukraine. They did. Ukraine was neutral when it became independent. That was part of its constitution. And its abandonment of neutrality and its acceptance of NATO and American weaponry on its soil posed an obvious threat to Russia, which Russia attempted to eliminate through negotiations, but was rebuffed, whereupon it resorted to the use of force. I think it is not Ukraine's advantage to have taken negotiations off the table once again with this incursion, because it just means more Ukrainians and more Russians, of course, too, will die, and more Ukrainian territory will be lost, as it is at the moment. I don't know anyone who believes that Ukraine will be able to hold on to the Kursk region indefinitely, but there are plenty of people who believe that Donetsk and Luhansk in Ukraine will be held by the Russians.
Yeah. The other thing would be that Zelensky said, if you could have given us long-range missile, we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't go on offensive, because it seems that he's wishing to attack Russia with long-range missiles. He's looking for some sort of permission from the United States. When you said that United Kingdom, together with Zelensky administration, were behind this attack, it totally makes sense to put some sort of pressure to get long-range missiles, I don't know, whatever they want.
Well, let's remember that the stated purpose of this war has been to weaken and isolate Russia. And many people in the West have hoped that weakening and isolating Russia would lead to regime change in Moscow. Mr. Putin has been demonized. He is the devil incarnate in Western eyes, and he must be in terrible political trouble. I don't think that's the reaction of Russians to attacks on Russian territory. Russians have a lot of experience with foreign invasions, going back to Napoleon, Hitler, and of course, Americans forget we invaded Siberia in 1918. to counter the Bolshevik Revolution wasn't a very smart thing to do. I don't think the Ukrainian incursion is going to end any more happily. And I think it will have the identical effect. That is, it will unite Russians in defense of the motherland. It will unite them behind Mr. Putin as their leader, their tsar, as it were. And it will not lead to the overthrow of Mr. Putin or the weakening of his control on Russia, whatever wishful thinkers in the West may believe.
Yeah. You've mentioned about Azerbaijan and how important is Azerbaijan for Israel. We recently learned, we've learned that they want to be part of BRICS. And right after the Putin's visit to Azerbaijan, he said that the president of Azerbaijan said that they want to be part of BRICS. And I'm really amazed by the U.S. foreign policy, because when you look at the right now, Azerbaijan, together Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, UAE, all these countries who are so important in terms of energy are part of BRICS. On the other hand, you see the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine, in the Middle East, is totally against the U.S., is totally against the benefits that can be considered for the United States. And how we can, why there is no position within the administration to challenge them on these policies?
Well, there, we are in the grips of a particularly debilitating form of groupthink. I don't know if you noticed, but the other day, there's a news outlet based in Lebanon, founded by a friend of mine, actually, called The Cradle. And The Cradle has been a very useful, almost invaluable source of commentary on events in the Middle East from a resistance, pro-Iranian, pro-Syrian, anti-American, if you will, perspective. Very useful. That has just been deplatformed by Meta, thrown off Instagram and Facebook and so on and so forth. And so we have we no longer have the First Amendment free speech that we did in this country, my country. And the United States, for better or ill, remains a dominant force in global media. And we are exercising our influence to stifle rather than invigorate debate. That's why you have your show, you do. It's why it's so important, because we have to turn to alternative media to hear viewpoints that are forbidden and banished from our usual media, including oligopolistic social media. So there we are. There is no rethinking in the United States. There is a lot of opposition, particularly among young people and among Jewish Americans who are disturbed by the association of Jews with Zionism, which they don't approve of anymore. The scales have fallen from our eyes in many ways. But the mainstream media are still slavishly following the Israeli Hasbara line put out by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel. Israel has been at war with the Palestinians at one level of intensity or another for 76 years. And a major component of this war has been information warfare. Very, very successful, because it has produced self-censorship in the West. Israelis don't have to do anything. They have conditioned people, like Pavlov's dog. You know, when he rang the bell, the dog salivated and got hungry. And now when the Israelis ring the bell, everybody shuts up and ceases to criticize them. Very effective, very skillfully done. As a former practitioner of propaganda for a brief time, I take my hat off to them. They are the champions. But, you know, you can only fool so many people so much of the time. And the contrast between what we can see with our own eyes and what they are telling us, as in Netanyahu's infamous speech to the U.S. Congress, nobody's starving in Gaza except Hamas is stealing all the food. All the trucks are going in. And Iran paid for the demonstrators outside. Well, of course, this is transparently foolish and a pack of lies. And the result is the next time an Israeli spokesman says something, people say, there they go again. Now they're telling another lie. You know, maybe sometime they would tell the truth and we would not believe it for that reason. So they have been their own worst enemy in this recent period. And I think a lot of people who are very sympathetic to Israel and who supported the establishment of the Zionist state in Palestine and want to see it prosper are appalled by what the Israelis have done to themselves and to us, because we are identified completely with them.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you, Nima, for what you do.
It's my pleasure. Bye-bye.